All right, this morning we want to do two things, and again, I have so much material that I'll not be able to get through all of it, so I'm going to be talking rather rapidly and going as fast as we can. But there have been some questions that have been handed in, and I'll answer them first, and then we'll go to something else. First of all, it was just handed in, is it scriptural to send flowers for the funeral of a member of the church and for the flowers to be paid for out of the church treasury? Isn't this a way of showing love, and often people that need flowers get very few? I could talk a long time on this. I think that under circumstances, you can take any circumstance and expand it out and find some kind of a scriptural justification for it. I think that in most cases it is unscriptural. I think that it is unwise to handle it in that way, that it should be done on an individual basis rather than on that particular basis. I agree with the fact that so many people who need flowers get very few. I think the solution to that is, rather than trying to institutionalize it, take it away from the individual, and then have some one individual in the church, the treasurer, somebody to buy flowers. Let's do what you people are doing here and try to study the matter and become more responsive to it, and each one of us respond on an individual way more than what we have in the past. Obviously, the person that handed this in is a person who has lost someone because they really, truly know how much flowers mean at that particular time. Another question is, my first wife's sister is in a hospital out of state with cancer. What is the proper words to say to her when we call her in sympathy? This again is very hard for me to say what is the proper thing to say, but I think that there's two or three guidelines that I can give you. And that is, when you call her, don't ignore the fact that she has cancer. Don't talk around it and say, how's the weather? How's John doing? You know, what's this? And how's the garden growing? And various things. But call her up and ask, how are you feeling? And let her talk about it. And then say, well, how are you coping with all of this? And if she breaks down and cries, let her cry. If she says, I think I'm going to die, then say, how do you feel about that? In other words, don't give her advice and say, well, now, you know, death would be the best in your case because you're very, very sick, and start in, you know, that philosophy sometimes that we feel. Just ask questions that will give her the opportunity to express herself. And remember, she's going through one of those five stages that you go through. She's somewhere in there. And until she gets to the last stage, the stage of acceptance, she's going to say some very unreasonable, illogical things. She's going to express anger. And when she expresses anger, don't get upset. That just means she's a little closer to accepting it. Another time you call her back after she's expressed anger, then you might find her in a bargaining mood. And she might say, oh, if I ever get over this, I promise you that I'll never miss another service. I'll give all my money to the Lord. I'll devote my life. And she may make some outlandish statements. I'll give my body to be burned. Don't say now, don't get rash. She's going through that stage. Just listen. She is having a relationship with God that she needs to have. She's talking to her God like a little child talks to mama and daddy. Mom and daddy understands that little child that comes in and says, mama, I'll give everything. You don't have to give me any more allowance for 20 years if you'll get me that new bicycle. I won't eat any more food for the next 5 years, you know. Well, you know that they don't mean that. They don't understand. So don't get upset about it. The next time you call her back, she may be in depression, just barely answering the phone. Hello. How you feeling? Terrible. Just the whole world's falling apart. That's normal. But it's good because you know that the next time you call her back, she will be accepting it. You have to go through these stages. And then one of these days you'll call her and she will accept it. How are you doing? She's all fine. Well, how's your cancer? Oh, it's just terrible. It's just, the doctors didn't give me but a few more days to live. Well, how are you feeling about that? Pretty good. And you'll think she's crazy. I call her and she's mad, and I call her another time. She said all those abnormal things. I call her another time. Right when things get tough, right down when at the very worst time, she seems like she's happy. That's normal. That's the way we die. And so keep that in mind, and I think it'll kind of help you. Fine. George handed that in. He told me last night, he said, I'm 84, and said, I'm getting the age right now where I'm beginning to learn a few things. And don't stick around a little while, George. You got a little more maturing to do. Okay. Here is one that is kind of interesting. The person had this in said, one of the things that women ask a lot is, how do you feel when you start dating again? And the answer to that is absolutely terrible. That dating is something that I talk a whole lot about, and all of it really would be humorous. A lady I've been dating wrote down with me this time, and been staying over at Truman's, and happy to have her here with me. And so when I asked her to come over and going to take her out to dinner, why, she lives 225 miles away, member of the church over in eastern Washington. And so she didn't eat, and so forth, and she drove over and came by my office, and so it's a noon hour, and we're getting ready to go down. I'm going to be a nice guy and take her to a pretty nice restaurant above McDonald's. And so we go down and sit down and order some coffee, and the waitress comes around and they say, you ready to order? And I said, could you give us a little more time? And the waitress comes around, you ready to order? Well, not yet. And the truth of the matter is, I could not eat. I could not possibly eat. I was trying to have enough time to get so that I could eat and visit with her, and I was sitting there thinking I was committing adultery. That's exactly the way you feel. Here it is. I have decided today's the day I will commit adultery in the middle of a restaurant in front of everybody. And what were we doing? She was sitting on that side of the table. I'm on this side, pull back a little ways. And we're talking, see, but you feel like you are committing adultery. Now, let me make up that point. In everything you do, you feel unfaithful. If you go out and you get a meal, I didn't order a full meal for months, because had I ordered a full meal and paid $4.50 or $5 for a full meal with a salad and everything, what would that have meant to Doris? She didn't get to eat that meal. Here it is, I'm enjoying this. I'm out eating a full meal without her, and the feeling is I'm unfaithful. I'm committing adultery. And everything you do, if you look at a pretty picture and you enjoy that, if you, whatever you do, you go somewhere and she's not there, you feel unfaithful. Now, you're going to feel unfaithful about all of these things. And so you just will get used to that, because that's something that is going to go through your mind all the time. But when you go out on your first date, that's when it's just a horrible, horrible feeling. It was a terrible day. She sat there, and she will tell you it was the worst day of her entire life. She thought that I was just too cheap to buy her a meal. Now that was part of it. But the other part was, I could not eat. And finally, the waitress, and finally, I told her, I said, I cannot eat. I'm not hungry. I cannot eat. Why don't you order? And she's nice enough. No, I won't order. And so she spent the rest of the day starved to death, hadn't eaten for 24 hours. And so that takes her on around to 36 hours. And I guess when she got to her daughter's home that night, she cleaned out the refrigerator. But about the only thing I can tell you is, take plenty of apple seltzer with you on your first date. It ain't fun. See? And then Al's asking me how it is now. It is fun. Okay. What I'm saying there is that things turn around, and after a period of time, then you do get so that you enjoy it. But the companionship of the opposite sex really is a very needful thing at the proper time. If you rush it and go into it before you're ready for it, it's just horrible. I think if you wait too late before you make any type of an overt effort to try to be with the opposite sex, it will hinder you from recovering just a little bit. If you do it at exactly the right time, of which I really feel that I did, if you do it at the right time, it's just going to be a miserable thing. That there's no way that you're going to do it with comfort. But then you can see later on, and I can truly say that she has helped me so much that, that there's just no way that I can express my appreciation for how much she's helped me through all these hours of grief. The sexual realm. How do you feel sexually? Every man, before his wife dies, feels that he would not be able to cope. That he would have to get married and get married just immediately, and there's no way that he would ever be able to cope, because if you had a good sexual relationship with your wife. And I did have a very, very pleasant sexual relationship with her. But at that time, the one thing that I feared the most was I could never, ever live without good sex. And at the time they tell you she's dead, those sexual desires are just shut off like flipping a light switch. They're shut off, and they gradually will come back. But as they gradually come back, then one or two things will happen. You either go crazy sexually, and a lot of people do that, or you really hold them under control and are no problem at all. Now, I'm thankful that the latter has been my situation. I never had any problems sexually at all. If it were a matter of getting married because of sexual needs, then I would never get married, because those needs are not there. Now, I think a good way to hold them under control is this. That tell yourself from the very beginning, and this is something that you won't believe, when all of a sudden it hit me, I have no right to sex anymore. Every married man knows he has a right to sex according to 1 Corinthians 7. All of a sudden, here it is, yesterday I had that right, today I do not have that right. And it's as though your arms have been taken away from you, something that belongs to you has been taken away from you. You don't believe it, yet intellectually you know it's true. And so tell yourself, I do not have that right. And then I thought about her, and I thought, well, okay, maybe I can satisfy it just by remembering the good sexual life we had. And then I think I did the right thing right there. And I said, no, I do not want to meditate on that. She is gone. Whatever life I have left, if there's any sexual activity, it will be with another woman. It won't be with her. God has taken her. And if she is not here, I do not want to spend my life fantasizing about the past. And so, to this day, I can say I have never fantasized and thought about my sexual relationships with my wife. I know that that is an unbelievable thing for a man to believe, what I just got through telling you. But what I'm telling you is the truth. And that's something that you do not need to fear if you handle it in the proper way. God will take care of the first two or three months for you. He'll just cut it off to where you won't have those desires. You take care of the rest of it by starting in and planting that seed in your mind. Sex, 95% of sex is all in your mind. There's only about 5% of it that is of a physical nature. And if you plant that in there while your sexual desires are away and say, I do not have a right, I will not, and I will control it, then those desires are not going to come back and flood in on you again. And again, I know it sounds unbelievable, but it is true. Now, what I want to do right now is talk here about what can you do to cope? What can you do for yourself? What are some of the things that you do? You lose a mate, and they come in and say, your mate is gone. Now, what are some of the things you can do to make it easier for you? This would be an hour or 2 hours lesson within itself. I see that I've got about 15, 20 minutes right here to talk about it, so we'll try to move on very, very rapidly. And so, put it down this way. First of all, the very day, the very moment that you're told your mate is dead, you're going to go through all those things that I talked about. But do this. You tell yourself, and this is really important, because this is what gets you through if you tell yourself. if you make up your mind. You tell yourself there's some things that must be done. Now, you're not going to feel like doing any of these. You're going to feel like they can't be done. But you tell yourself that you have 1 year of misery ahead of you. That you're just like an individual that is taken to prison and thrown in prison and the door slammed and you didn't do anything to deserve that. But you're in prison. Now, what would you tell that guy? See, I would tell him, all right, you have 1 year. Now, you're in prison. Now, you either make the best of it, or you go in there and kick the bars and take your tin cup and rattle and cry and scream and whatever you want to do, but you're not going to get out of here within a year. And so I would advise that guy to get some books and read, try to better yourself, try to learn something about prison, try to do those things, and you'll come out a better individual. That's what I would tell you. That's what I would tell you. Accept the self that to yourself, you're sentenced to 1 year. For the first 6 months, it's going to be the most horrible experience you've ever had in your entire life. For the next 6 months, you're going to have a whole lot of relief, but you're going to go through a tremendous amount of grief. At the end of the year, you're going to start progressing and getting better in a rather rapid pace. So just accept it. I have a year. Then the next thing, I must go through. Now, what you're going to feel emotionally is, I can't, I won't, I can't, and I will not. Tell yourself, I must go through it. The next thing is, tell yourself, I will go through it. Now, you're going to want to die more than anything in all the world. If you have your prerogatives, you would have God to take your life. But you tell yourself, because this is what's going to happen. Look around at all the people right here in this audience. We've all lived through it. And you are going to live through it too. So you will live through it. So accept that fact from the very beginning. Then, tell yourself this, which gives you a little comfort. None of these gives you a whole lot, but it puts a groundwork. It builds a foundation so that you go into it in a sensible way. Say, how do I know I can live through it? Because I know it's humanly impossible the way I feel. Tell yourself others have done it, and they come through okay, and I will too. Now, emotionally, you won't feel that way. But intellectually, tell yourself that. Use other people and say, they did it, and I will too. And then the next thing, go to God immediately. Go to God and thank God. It's going to be hard for you to do. And you think, well, I can thank God for anything. You can't. It's going to be hard for you to do. And then all of a sudden, you're going to realize why Paul urges Christians to, in everything, give him thanksgiving. That's kind of odd that we would have to be commanded to thank God. Because we think we're so righteous, we thank him for everything. We don't. When tragedies come in, do you thank God for the tragedies you have? And here's one that you're not going to be able to endure, you think. Now thank God. And just, you say, what do you say? Say whatever's on your mind. You say, God, I don't understand. I do not understand. I don't think I can live. I want you to take my life, if you will. I don't care what you say. You thank God. And you thank God that he gave you your mate. You thank God that in his wisdom, he has taken your mate, even though you don't have the slightest idea of why. One day, you'll be able to thank him with some intelligence. Right then you do it. Now otherwise, you're going to start turning and holding God guilty. Many people then have a terrible relationship with God. They hold God guilty. They can't pray. I talked to one lady here in Oregon that for about 7 or 8 months, she was unable to pray to God. Never prayed, because it hit just like that. Okay, another thing now. Here are some things I have found that help me. Here are some things you can do. None of these things are going to cure it, but every one of them will help you cope a little bit better. First of all, face things immediately. Immediately say, I will go out and face things. Now you want to hide. You won't want to go to a restaurant where you used to go. You won't want to go to Sears if that's where you did the shopping. You won't want to go out because everything will remind you of your loved one. Now what I did was this, and it really helped me. The next morning I got up, I took my family, and I went to the restaurants where we used to go. I went to one restaurant, went in, ordered a cup of coffee, and sat and cried. And I pointed out and told my kids. So we sat at this table, we did this, we did that, we did this. And I cried. I took a cup of coffee, paid the bill, and left. We went to another restaurant, I ordered another cup of coffee. And we hit every restaurant in town. And every time I'd go in, I'd sit down, order coffee, and cry because of the hurt and the pain that I experienced at that time. After we got through with all the restrooms, we went to the grocery stores. And I walked up and down the aisle where I'd pushed the basket for her. And every box on there, every box of Wheaties, everything would bring back a memory. And I cried up and down those aisles. We got through with that. I went over to Ernst Hardware, where she walked through with me if I went in to buy a tube of four or a screw. I walked up and down, and I cried. And we spent the entire day going to all those places and facing them and just crying. But I spent one day getting over the first things. Go and face things immediately. Because you have to face it head on. They're going to catch up with you sometime anyway. Another thing is, always do what comes naturally. Now, at this time, you're going to want to do what doesn't come naturally. People in their misguided zeal are going to want you, you know, to grin or joke or buck up and don't do this or don't do that. You do what comes naturally to you. Don't play games. Don't go in that game-playing thing and say, oh, this is the best and all of that. If you say, oh, I know it's the best that God took her, be truthful. I'd say, I know it's the best, but I don't understand why. I could give you some reasons, but I don't understand it. See, I know it's the best only because I know that all things will work together for good. But someday I'll understand it, but I don't now. Just do what comes naturally. Always be honest with yourself. You're the only one you can't fool. You might be able to go out and fool other people and make other people think you're all right. But when you go home behind those doors, they don't know the misery that you're going through. And when they ask you, and how are you doing? Oh, great, great. When you're just absolutely a miserable individual, it might be the best for you to tell them, I'm doing great sometimes and sometimes I'm not. Just always be honest with yourself. If you're ever going to be honest, now's the time to do it. Then another thing, do good when the opportunity presents itself. Now you will find opportunities to do good that you've never had before, and you'll never have them again. Let me tell you an unusual opportunity I had. Well, there's a young boy up there that grew up, well, I've been up there for 26 years, and so he grew up as a little boy, and he was a friend of mine, sons, and over to our house a lot, and thought a lot of me and my wife. And finally, he got in those teenage years, and he rebelled, and he went away, and just gave his parents all kind of heartaches and all of this. And my wife was always concerned about him. She would always send Stephen a birthday card and say, Stephen, I'm thinking of you, and would like for you to come back to the Lord. And nothing would touch him. Everybody tried everything. At one end of the funeral, and I sat down behind that glass back there and looked out, and there sat Stephen out there with tears in his eyes. And it's the first time I'd seen him for years. And so I looked up, and he looks over, and I called him into the family room. And he came in, and I said, Stephen, I'd like for you to sit with the family. And I had him to move over and had him to sit by me. And I asked him, he said, have you seen her body? And he said, no. And so I took him out to look at the casket. Everybody was there. The funeral was getting ready to start. And took him out, and he looked at her, and he broke down and cried. And right there at that casket, I was able to say some things to him that I was never able to say before. No other person could ever have said them. And I was able to say, Stephen, I want you to know how she died. The other day, we were driving down a certain road, and she's talking about you and about your birthday. And how she wanted to send you a card because she thought, basically, you're a good boy. And she wanted you to come back to the Lord. And he broke down and said, I know it, and I've got to do it. And I talked to him and said, that is something that was her life's goal, was to try to bring you back. Will you come back? And he said, I will. And he did the following Sunday. The morning after she died, there were two people that having marital problems, good friends of ours. I've never been able to reach them. We've never really been able to talk about them. But Doris and I was talking about what we can do. And I called them up and asked them to come over. And at that time, I had the opportunity to sit down in front of both of them. And sit down and say, now I want to talk to you about your marriage. I want you to know right now that someday you're going to be sitting right here where I'm sitting. And I want you to know that you're never going to feel like this. And it's going to be horrible for you because you don't treat each other the way you should. And Doris and I were talking about you last week. And I want you to start immediately. You've got to straighten out your life. And they sat there as two little children. And they agreed and said, we've got to do it. And things are looking better. And it's been a situation of where Helen and I have been able to pick up the pieces And now we're working with them, and maybe in the last years of their life, they'll be able to have a happy marriage and die without those tremendous guilt feelings. But just things like that that you find. You are going to have opportunities. Take advantage of them. God gives them to you, and it'll make you feel good that you do something. The next thing is cry. Don't try to cry, but don't hold back just to show people how strong you are. The next is read books on the subject. Now, I've got, and Al's got this sheet right here, and I'm not going to go through it, of some books. The ones I think really are the best to read is the order that I've given them to you right there. And they're very simple. Most of them are rather difficult to read, but these are very simple, and they just tell it like it is. And as you read those books, you begin to realize that everybody else feels like I do. And I just don't think that's possible, but they do. And it impacts you, and it makes you understand you're not alone. Others have walked the path. And it helps you understand some things that await you. And so I go through and I read those, and then I look forward, okay, at 6 months, at 12 months, what can I look forward to? At 18 months, what can I look forward to? That's where I am now. And I am experiencing exactly the things that the books say you will experience in 18 months. Now my next big one right now, I'm looking forward to 2 years. Because in 2 years, in six more months, I'm supposed to have some other feelings. I'm looking forward to that a whole lot more than I'm looking forward to Christmas. And so learn what you can know about these things. The next is read the cards that are sent to you. Sit down and read those little poems. That they all of a sudden those little poems become meaningful to you. All of a sudden you see things in those little poems that you've never seen before. And all of a sudden you realize that every one of those little poems was written by somebody who had lost a loved one. Nobody could write that poem on there if they had not experienced it. Now, no poet in the world could do it unless they'd lost a loved one. And then you can start relating it. Every once in a while, there'll be a little remark down there that this person lost her husband, her son, or something. You understand, she understands it more than what I do. Then read the little remarks that are written. Read them. And you will find then, and you'll know clearly, that person is trying to tell me they love me. They don't know what to say. But that's what you'll really appreciate. Here it is, they're stumbling along. It's clear as a bell. They don't know what to say. It's a stumbling letter. But it's so meaningful how much that person must love me. What agony they went through sitting at the table thinking, what can I write to Lord? What can I say? No, nothing they could say, but they tried. I really appreciated that. I really, really appreciated that. Then write your own thank you cards. Don't have somebody else to do it. You want to have somebody else to do it, generally, but do it yourself. You're now expressing yourself. And what you're doing is, it's going to take a period of time for you to say goodbye to that loved one. So you're starting to express yourself, writing people, thank you for coming, thank you for sending flowers, thank you, and there's going to have to be a million of these before you can finally admit she's gone. Let people help you in things you don't feel like doing. Do what you feel like doing. But when other people want to do something for you and you don't feel like doing, let them help you. This is the time you need help. Then do what you feel like doing. Don't do what other people feel like you ought to be doing. But you do what you feel like that you're doing. To give you an illustration. I was literally unable to plan 24 hours in advance. It's the first time in my life that I ever understood what I had been preaching. Jesus said, live today. You know, let tomorrow take care of itself. People would come and they'd say, Lord, can you come? This would be on Sunday. Can you come over for dinner Tuesday night? And when they said that, for me to set up an appointment to where I had to be there was more than I could take. Because I didn't know where I'd be. I didn't know whether I'd be in Africa. I didn't know whether I'd be dead. And I told them, I said, I don't know. I don't know if I can be there Tuesday night. Call me Tuesday afternoon and I'll tell you whether I can be there. And I would not set up an appointment. I could not set up an appointment. And I didn't force myself into it. And the people understood. And so they'd call me Tuesday afternoon. Can you make it? Yeah, I can make it. I'm still alive. I was there that day. And then it was easy. Yeah, I can make it. But you're going to find that there's things that you just can't handle. Don't let people force you into doing something that you can't handle. Stay busy. Just stay busy and make work if you have to. Get out there and stay busy. That's the key. God set down. Stay busy. The next, dress nicely. There's never a time in your life that you should dress as nice as what you do this. I got up every day. I put on suits and ties, and boy, I dressed up, and you'd have thought it was President Reagan walking out of that house. I had tears running down my cheeks. My face was as white as snow. I was sick. I was a miserable, wretched mess. Nobody really could enjoy being around me because I had one thing on my mind, and I was crying. And as far as a human being was concerned, I was as miserable a wretch as you could possibly have pulled out of a ditch. But I'll tell you something. There wasn't a better looking guy than what I was. I went out, boy, I had that tie on, and I went out like I was important. And your dress does help you feel that way. Now, if you dress like you feel, then you're going to feel like you dress. But if you don't dress like you feel, and you dress, I mean, you put on the best you've got, all of a sudden, you're going to see, that starts helping me. It helps me feel better. Then, always remember that the first things hurt the most. Don't ever ignore them. Go right at them. And that means go to your home and go to your bed. When people say, well, why don't you come home with me and stay for 2 or 3 weeks? Don't do it. Not unless it's an abnormal situation. Go home. Go to that bed. Go back and face those things. Get it over with today. I know of one individual down in Houston. His wife died, and 18 months later, he had locked up the house. People go over to look at it and clean it up, and he wouldn't let any clothes to be removed, no furniture moved. 18 months later, he still had to fight this. He had to go in and do it all. And just terrible, terrible psychological damage that it did to him. Go and do it immediately. Now, after you go to places with others, like I was talking about, stores and restaurants, then go alone. After I'd gone with my children, then I said, okay, now it's time for me to go. I went downtown, and I went into Safeway. I had no idea what I would do. I got me a basket, and I rolled up and down the aisles, and I cried, and I cried, and I cried. And I went through there, and then I remembered that I needed some paper towels in the kitchen in there, needed some to clean up a mess. So I went over and got 3 or 4 big old bundles of paper towels so I'll get enough to last me for 4 or 5 years, and I won't have to come in here again. That's the truth. And so I filled up the basket with paper towels. I got home, took them out, and all of it was toilet paper. And so I had all of that. And so I go to some other places, and I do this and that. And then the next day, I thought, well, I got to go get those paper towels. I went in, I went back through, I went over. This time I filled that thing up with paper towels again, another 4 or 5 of those things. Took them home, opened them up, and every one of them was toilet paper. And now I've got that all over the house. And so the third trip I went, it was hard. I mean, you laugh. I'm telling you, so you will laugh, but so you'll not think you're crazy when you do it. It was really tough for me to look at a little boy, take that off, I read it. As I say toilet paper, paper towels. I've done this twice, paper towels. Are you sure? And I turn it around and I feel it, just like a little kid, you see, that's doing that. And the third time, I want to show you, I'm not as dumb as you think I am. The third time, Al, I did it right. I got toilet paper. Next point. Don't let anyone bind you by putting time limits on you. When they tell you, oh, in 2 months you'll be feeling better. If you do, fine. Now, I've given you general time limits. You're going to find within the general. But don't let anybody say, now, next week, you know, you're going to have to do this. It may not be that you make it. Talk to others who have been there. That's important, let me tell you something. Find solace, talk to others. How do you grieve? What advice can you give me? But then get prepared, because they may give you the exact opposite advice, because they didn't handle grief correctly. Let me tell you the first thing that happened to me. 1 month after my wife died, I went over to visit my daughter and attend services in another congregation, and there was a couple people about 40 years old who both had lost their mates and they'd remarried. So I go back to them, and they extend their sympathy, and I said, tell me when I can ever expect to get over this pain to where I could start thinking about remarriage or anything like this. Tell me, when could you possibly do it? And they looked at me and said, we don't know. Oh, you don't? No. So we don't know. It's, we haven't gotten over it yet. I look up, you poor, poor people. There they are married, and then I find out they're having all kind of marital problems because they didn't handle it correctly. They've gotten married too soon, and now then they're spending the rest of their life regretting that. So I back out of that. I call some people. I remember I called an individual. He was 80-some years old, an old preacher. And I called him and asked him, tell me, can I find happiness? When can I find happiness? And then he starts telling me, yeah, you can. Then he starts telling about the agony he went through, and he started talking to me like I've been talking to you about how badly he was hurt, and he'd try to put his hand over on her knee, and she wasn't there, and he would cry. And I ended up on that phone conversation giving him comfort, see, instead of him giving me, and I got off of the phone real quickly. And that's the reason I appreciate Brother Haley. Alright, Brother Haley, can I be happy? Yeah, sure you can, yeah. You know, sure, no doubt about it. Are you sure? Yeah, sure. You see, and you really appreciate somebody. So what I'm saying is, if you get somebody that says, oh, it's the worst thing, you'll never get over it, oh, I don't know when, then just back off and say, bless their heart, they need help. And go find somebody else. You'll find somebody that'll tell you the truth. Somebody that's been through it, they've handled it, they'll tell you the truth, they'll tell you how bad it is. But unless they tell you, it also can get good. Don't you believe it? The next thing is, write down your feelings and keep a record the very best you can. It helps you progress along and see. You can say, well, 6 weeks ago I felt this way, now I feel better. And every little improvement helps you. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Now you will, but don't. You will, but say, uh-oh, I'm starting to feel sorry for myself. And then give yourself a talk. Get yourself back out of that. Don't try to impress people with how much you love them and continue to grieve beyond what's natural. Now, this is a normal thing to do. You're going to find that when the time comes that you need to get out of this, that you won't want to quit grieving. You'll want to stay grieving. Everybody does this. You'll start to feel better. You'll start to become happy. And you'll say, I can't do that. If I do that, then that'll mean I didn't love them as much. I love my wife so much that I should spend the rest of my life in misery. See, that's how much I love her. And I can't do that. What will people think if they see me laughing and grinning? They'll think I didn't love Doris very much. And so you'll try every way in the world to stay in grief. That sounds funny, but everybody tries to do that. And so when you see that, understand, if you don't handle it properly, you are not going to get over it. Did the bell ring? Okay, I didn't hear the bell ring. Okay, there's so many other things that I've got down here that there's no use of going on into it. If you would like a copy of this, if you are going through grief, Al has some there that he could make you a copy of that you can go ahead and read. Okay, thank you.